You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about the day after tomorrow. And I don't mean Sunday. I mean the latest movie from director Roland Emmerich. The threat to the world as we know it is no longer invading aliens from space, as in Emmerich's last film, Independence Day. Rather, it's an abrupt climate change as a result of global warming. But is this just another fantastical disaster flick? Here's the plot. It revolves around a Washington, D.C. paleoclimatologist who tries to warn the government of the impending onset of a new ice age. And in the meantime, his son, hours away in New York, holes up in the public library while a monster storm, the biggest event in 10,000 years, as the papers call it, rages outside. Now, the story is more about the father's attempts to rescue his son, which involves snowshoeing from D.C. to Manhattan, than global warming. But nevertheless, it touches on some important issues. Could the scenes from the movie become reality if we don't address global warming? Is abrupt climate change a serious threat? So for the rest of the hour, we'll sort out the science from the fiction, the hype of the day after tomorrow. Where will you be listening to the radio, I hope? If you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And before we launch into our discussion of global warming and the threat of abrupt climate change, we have the producer of the movie, Roland Emmerich. The director is on the line with us all the way from Europe. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Emmerich.
Hello.
Did you have any bigger motives, social relevant motives, than just making a great action movie involved here?
Well, you know, like when I did my first movie in Germany, you know, my very, very first movie was about, like, weather control. Mm-hmm. So that's an old theme of mine.
Mm-hmm. And so you're just continuing on that theme?
Well, you know, roughly 4 years ago, I discovered a book called The Coming of the Global Superstorm.
Right.
It's written by Whitley Strieb and Art Belt, not probably the people you know you would like kind of call scientists.
Right.
And I thought, why are these science fiction guys, you know, like kind of writing a book about weather? And I kind of checked it out, and it sounded very much like kind of science fiction at first, and then three or four weeks later, I read the first article in another kind of like more respectable, magazine, you know, where it was pretty much the same theory. And I thought, wait a moment. And then I kind of really dived into it and did a lot of research and realized, you know, there is like a lot of like kind of a real science, you know, to their theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided to make the movie.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the movie The China Syndrome?
Yes,
and that was a fictional tale about a nuclear reactor possibly melting down, but it had a great impact on the future of the nuclear industry.
Yes, it had.
Do you think that your movie is going to have that sort of same impact on thinking about global climate change?
I think the movies are very different from each other. You know,
yeah.
I'd like to do a summer movie, and I wanted to do a summer movie. That's what I'm good at, and so I kind of traumatized it a little bit more than they did.
And you felt you had to speed things up in the film as opposed to the...
Yeah, I mean, like in the book it was sped up, you know, and I thought it was like a legitimate thing to do because the underlying, you know, like problem, like global warming, you know, can lead to disaster is very real.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, it's like a... It was more like kind of meant as like a wake-up call.
Yeah, I see. And, you know, it's interesting that not long after you filmed the sequence of the Antarctic ice shelf breaking off...
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The giant Larsen B ice shelf actually did break off of Antarctica.
Well, there was a lot of like kind of severe weather events lately, like kind of last 2-3 years, and when you like kind of talk to scientists, you know, they're all very worried, and like only lately, you know, even the Pentagon discovered, you know, the threat of an abrupt climate shift.
Mm-hmm. So, what's your response to global warming naysayers now? Do they?
Well, I mean, that's amazing for me. You know, there's like, if you ask like kind of 1,000 scientists, you know, and there's like always like one or two like kind of, you know, deny it, and the other like kind of 998, you know, say it's very real. I mean, mm-hmm. Who would you believe? You know, it's simply a matter of numbers. You know,
mm-hmm. How much was it? Was it imperative that you get the science right here?
We had like kind of throughout, you know, the writing and shooting of the movie, constant contact with scientists, mm-hmm. you know, because we didn't want it to go too much off. So all the underlying theory, you know, what's happening, you know, like kind of through global warming, you know, the Gulf Stream gets like kind of shut down, is very real. Then from the moment on the storm hits, it's it's simply fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to kind of do something very dramatic because mm-hmm. I want to kind of really tell a great rescue story. I always like think, you know, disaster movie, it's a great rescue story. So I had to speed things up.
Yeah, so because the story is the movie.
Yeah,
that's the heart of every kind of drama.
Also, I mean, I always say, you know, when have you seen the last time that a Hollywood popcorn movie kind of steers that much controversy, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I did my job already.
Yeah, and are you gonna stay on the climate theme a little longer in another movie, perhaps?
No, I don't think so. But I really, as a human being, I want to kind of be involved beyond the movie. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about the subject. You know, I am in contact with a lot of organizations, and I want to keep working with these organizations.
Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. I appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Roland Emmerich is the director of the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which opens in cinemas around the world today. Let me introduce my guest for the rest of the hour. We're going to talk about, the Roland's efforts at putting, he said he tried to get real science in there. How much is science? How much is fiction? Does it matter? Is the movie a learning tool, or is there so much wrong in the movie that it might actually turn people off to the idea of global warming? What do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Eileen Clausen is the president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change in Arlington, Virginia. She joins us today from her office there. Welcome back to the program, Eileen Clausen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kevin Trenberth is the head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He joins us from his office in Boulder, and it's good to have you back on Science Friday, Dr. Trenberth.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
What did you think of the science there, Dr. Trenberth?
Well, I have not seen the movie, but I've heard quite a lot about it. I've seen the trailers, and as was indicated, it's not a documentary. It's clearly mixing up fact and fiction, and the question is the extent to which the public will be able to sort out one from the other. It does have a physical basis. You know, global warming is really happening. The thermohaline circulation in the ocean has changed abruptly in the past. In 11,000 years ago, in particular, was one major event, and it's associated with large changes in climate around the world. And we certainly understand that abrupt climate change is a real risk. So,
but the movie says it can happen a matter of days, virtually, in the film. Science research doesn't really say it could happen that quickly, does it?
Not really, but some aspects of it can happen quite abruptly, because even though global warming itself occurs relatively slowly and steadily because the humans are burning fossil fuels and changing the composition of the atmosphere, and a very steady but slow buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that causes a warming, and the oceans respond, and presumably initially in a relatively slow and steady rate. But we may come to a point where you reach a threshold and suddenly the behavior of the atmosphere above that ocean changes radically, and that can communicate around the world very quickly on a time scale. These kinds of things can happen on a time scale of a week or two. And the best example I can illustrate for that kind of thing is when we have an El Nino event in the tropical Pacific, such as we had in 1997-98. And so there's a warming going on that we can track in the ocean, and then as it becomes large enough in the central and eastern Pacific, suddenly there's a major change around the world, and it changes where all the storms develop and how mm-hmm. strong they are and where they go. And it constitutes, in this case, climate variability, but if it continues for a long period of time, it would make climate change.
In the movie, I mentioned about this ice shelf breaking off of Antarctica, which changes what's called the thermohaline circulation. Can you explain what that is and how that might plausibly lead to sort of a winter time instead of a warming?
Well, the thermohaline circulation, thermo refers to heat, and the haline refers to salt. And these are the two ingredients in the ocean that determine the density of the water in the ocean. So at high latitudes, the water is cold, which means it's dense. And also, as you form sea ice, then that rejects the salt part, the brine, into the ocean, and it makes it more salty. And so that also makes the water dense. And so that that cold, salty water tends to sink, and this creates a circulation within the ocean, and that circulation then drags warmer water towards the poles. And in the North Atlantic, it's related very much to the Gulf Stream, bringing warmer water up towards Europe, for instance, and then this colder water returning at depth within the ocean. And so this ocean circulation is transporting heat to higher latitudes. And if we then shut down that thermohaline circulation, and in the past it's thought that that might have happened by a flushing of the North Atlantic, for instance, by the melting of the glaciers at the end of the last ice age, and then that would change the heat transport by the ocean and would cause regional changes in climate as a result of that.
So that the Gulf Stream doesn't get as far north anymore. And
that's right.
It cools off England and northern the U.S., the scenario in this movie.
Yes.
Eileen Clawson, do you think there is a risk of making climate change so unbelievable as perhaps in this, you know, what's going on in this movie with all the tornadoes and how quickly this happens, that people might be less inclined to believe the real warnings about global warming?
No, actually, I don't think that will be the result. I think this will raise people's awareness of the issue. And while I think the movie itself is science fiction rather than science, not to say that you couldn't have some abrupt climate change, but I think not in the severity shown in the movie or with quite the speed shown in the movie, I think a lot of people are using this movie as a way to talk about what the issue really is, what we really know about it, and what we can really do about it. So I actually think it's going to be very helpful in starting what we really have to start, which is a national debate about the problem and what we can honestly do about it.
You think this movie might have any real effect on starting that debate in places where it counts?
Well, I only say that because I can't tell you how many people in the press I've talked to over the last week about what global warming is, what we can do, and so on. And I think a lot of people are using it as a way to have an honest discussion, which is terrific.
The Kyoto Accord is mentioned in the film. The fictitious vice president objects to it on the grounds of how much it costs. Is Kyoto still relevant to us? We never signed that agreement.
Well, Kyoto is an interesting case. I think the Russians, Putin announced just this week that he was going to go ahead and ratify the Kyoto Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
So that will mean that the agreement goes into effect. No, the United States is not a party. I think the United States will not become a party because the requirements for the U.S. Would approach so rapidly that even if things really changed here and we decided to be serious about this issue, which I hope we will, we probably wouldn't join the Kyoto Agreement as it stands right now. But the fact that it is likely to go into effect as Russia ratifies means that a lot of countries are actually going to start making sure that they meet their emission targets, and that is terrific. And even more important than that, there's a forcing mechanism within the Kyoto Protocol which says starting next year, you have to start thinking about what comes next after 2012. I would hope the U.S. would become a part of that dialogue, and that's when we really do have to get serious.
Could we catch up? We seem to be so far behind. If we were to start tomorrow?
No, I don't think we could catch up with the target that was negotiated in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
But do I think we could be a constructive part of a next agreement with some targets that instead of having our emissions keep growing, which is what the current policy is, mm-hmm. actually make them come down? Yeah, I think we could be a part of that, and I would hope we would be a part of that.
We're talking about the film The Day After Tomorrow on this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Eileen Clawson and Kevin Trenberth. Kevin, is there a sort of an accepted scenario of how global warming should play itself out in the next 100 years?
There are projections for the mm-hmm. next 100 years, and all of the climate models that we have do not include an abrupt climate change in them. There is a slowdown of the thermohaline circulation in many of the climate models on that kind of a time frame, and that can mean that there is complexity to climate change. Global warming does not mean warming everywhere over the globe and in a monotonic fashion where it just inexorably gets warmer. One of the things that will happen is that some places will get warmer than the global average, some places will get cooler, and some places may even cool a little bit. And that's very much related to changes in the ocean currents and changes in the atmospheric circulation as the climate changes. And generally, of course, we're expecting that there's a warming. A lot of the heat from global warming goes into evaporation, evaporating moisture over the oceans and over land where it's available. And so this also affects what we call the hydrological cycle, in other words, availability of rainfall and also drying. And so this can have a great impact on water resources. Mm-hmm. I think myself, that's likely to be one of the biggest impacts.
Mm-hmm. There's a report from the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which is due for release in November, detailing some of the effects of climate change in Alaska. If you go up to Alaska, you see some amazing things up there, don't you?
Well, the biggest warming and some of the largest manifestations today are occurring in Alaska. That's partly a result of the nature of the changes in the atmospheric circulation that have occurred. As a result of that, actually, there's been a bit less warming on the eastern parts of the United States, ironically, Washington, D.C., note. But that doesn't mean that there aren't changes in the eastern parts of the United States. In some sense, it's because it has become a bit wetter. Mm-hmm. But just to come back to one of the points when you were talking about Kyoto, you know, the complaint that implementing Kyoto has a cost, one of the things this movie does highlight is that there's also an enormous cost of climate change if you get it wrong. And I don't think those costs are being factored into this. And we're seeing some of that in Alaska with regard to the effects of the permafrost changing, for instance, and the damage it does to buildings and roads and the infrastructure that exists.
Mm-hmm. Eileen Claussen, we've seen states take the burden of regulations on themselves where they feel that the federal government hasn't stepped in, like in pollution control, emissions, things like that. Could they act individually for climate change too?
Well, I think it's interesting because they are acting individually. I mean, you've got a group of states in the mid-Atlantic and the Northeast who are designing a cap-and-trade system for that region mm-hmm. with serious emission reduction requirements. It's being led, actually, by Governor Pataki. You've got three states on the West Coast that are trying to get together and figure out a regional approach to dealing with climate change there. You've got 14 states that require a certain percentage of renewables in their electricity mix. You've got all kinds of activities at the state level because many, many governors and state bureaucrats are looking at the problem and saying, this is real and there's nothing happening at the national level, so why don't we go ahead and try it?
Mm-hmm. But these things will have to play themselves out over time.
They will, but quite honestly, if we do get continued, particularly successful efforts at the state level, mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to be that long before we have a national program because nothing will drive industry more crazy than 50 different sets of requirements in 50 different states.
Interesting. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about global warming with Eileen Claussen and Kevin Trenberth. Take your phone calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about global warming and the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which came out today. My guests are Eileen Claussen, the president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, Kevin Trenberth, head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, known by those who love it as NCAR. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones, to Jack in, is it Cabiz, Kentucky?
Yeah, thank you.
Go ahead.
I've got a question about whether or not it's possible that the changes are part of a natural cycle that the planet may go through. I've heard some research that showed that there's a 110-year cycle that shows that the planet goes through warming trends and then cools back down. And, of course, we've got the periods in history where there were ice ages that have repeated throughout time. Is it possible that all this is not necessarily a fault of us, but then again, there's also nothing we can do about it?
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Yes, of course, the climate has varied in the past. We have gone through major ice ages, but the ice ages and the glacial to interglacial sequences typically occur with a time scale of tens of thousands of years. They're driven mostly by the orbital changes of the Earth around the Sun in a reasonably understood way. And the last major glacial maximum, the major ice age, occurred about 20,000 years ago. The last 10,000 years have been the period we call the Holocene, where we've come out of that, although technically we're still actually in an ice age because there's permanent ice in Antarctica and Greenland. And the estimates from the past record give us some idea as to how rapidly climate can change and what the amplitude of that change is. And we can also try and simulate this in models and get an estimate of this. And the best estimate is that without changes in the sun or changes in things like volcanoes, which can certainly play a role in climate change, that the range of climate is about plus or minus 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit in terms of the global mean temperature. And the thing is, we're now outside of that range, and we appear to be outside of that range after about 1980 or thereabouts. And in addition, we know that the carbon dioxide has increased in the atmosphere by over 30%. There's very well documented evidence of that. And we know that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It produces warming. And our climate models suggest that there's a very direct relationship with the global increases in temperature that are going on. And so we're quite confident that global warming is happening. And the thing is, it's happening at a rate which is much greater than occurs in nature.
Interesting. Is there evidence of the oceans rising yet?
Yes, indeed. Sea level is rising. One of the exciting things that's going on is we've got good measurements from satellites now of global sea level for the last 10 years or so. And sea level has gone up about an inch and a quarter in the last 10 years. We believe overall in the last century that it went up about 6 inches, but the rate of rise at the moment is much faster than that. And this, of course, has major consequences for small island states and coastal regions. And that's one of the big long-term impacts is sea level rise.
It's not just an environmental impact. It's a monetary impact. You have to divert money you might be spending on education or schools or building projects now to shoring up the shoreline.
Well, this becomes especially a problem in places like New Orleans or in the Gulf Coast where the land is actually subsiding somewhat as well. Mm-hmm. And so there's a tremendous amount of resources going into building dikes of various kinds and big pumps in order to keep the water out.
Yeah, and flooding subways and things, you know, bad hurricanes, stuff like that.
Yes, it can affect water supplies as well with infusion of salt into water supplies.
Eileen Klussen, are businesses, you know, making any changes to minimize or to get ready for global warming?
Well, I think if you look at the leaders in business, there are about 30 or 35 companies that have set emission reduction targets, and some of them have actually already met the targets that they may have set like 3 or 4 years ago, and some of them are enormous. I mean, a company like DuPont set an emission reduction program in place to reduce their emissions by 65% below 1990 levels by 2010, mm-hmm. and they met it already. Well, I mean, you know, Kyoto was talking about 7% reduction or 8% reduction, and here's a company that managed a 65% reduction, and they managed it without spending a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's really important. BP met its target, 10% below 1990 levels by 2010, and made $650 million in the process. So there are companies who are showing, one, that it can be done, two, that you can do a lot at either a profit or at no cost. And, you know, quite honestly, what is the excuse for not moving forward, at least in a modest way? I can't think of any.
Normally, as the president has said, it's an economic problem. It's going to cost jobs or money.
Right, and I think that's – I'm not sure what that's based on, except some models constructed in a way that would show that the costs are really high and believed by people or used by people so that we don't do anything.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Nick in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Love your show. I listen every Friday.
Thank you.
One question is, I saw a program on PBS locally about polar change in that the positive and negative charges switch, which was theorized there was a major climate change at the time. Is that a possibility in the future? And would it have any consequences similar to the movie?
Mm-hmm. In other words, with the reversal of the poles, which happens every once in a while, would that have anything to do with the global climate change? Kevin?
It's not quite related to just what we're talking about. You're correct. There are changes in the magnetism of the Earth that have happened with time for reasons that are not fully understood, and that the magnetic field of the Earth does affect the solar particles that are coming into the planet, and so it can affect the upper atmosphere and could have an impact on things like the ozone layer, and so that in turn could have some impact on the weather. But it's not related to global warming as such.
Mm-hmm. There have been some interesting stories in the last week about how much reflectivity the Earth has and how that has been changing, how much light has been bouncing off of it. Any comment on that?
Yes, I've followed those, but I think there's a bit more work to be done on that because it seems to be a little bit at odds with some other direct evidence that exists, and there are some problems with some of the satellite data that exist that have been used in that study, I think. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very real issue. How do clouds change as the climate change? And clouds are one of the things that we don't do particularly well in our climate models. And so they add an extra layer of uncertainty to what we can say about might happen in the future. And so this is a serious issue. And in this particular study, looking at the brightness of the moon, looking at Earthshine, so to speak, the reflection of the sun from the Earth onto the moon, to get some idea as to how the brightness of the Earth is changing was quite ingenious in many ways, but it also means that you have to look at the whole of the Earth, and they only had one telescope looking at one from one location, and so I think they got a slightly distorted view of things.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jack in Oberlin Park, Kansas. Hi, Jack.
Howdy.
Howdy.
My question is, from this perspective of us individuals, what do they, the experts, expect us, the individuals, to do about it? I'm currently driving home 14 miles from work. What do they expect me to do, walk?
Eileen Clausen?
Absolutely not. But I think when you make the choice of what kind of a car to drive, you should also look at things like its efficiency, because that can make an enormous difference. We have some cars that can do two or even three times as good in terms of energy efficiency as other cars.
You mean miles per gallon?
Miles per gallon. And it would be great if consumers as a whole thought about these kinds of issues, thought about energy issues, and made smart choices that are climate friendly.
Does that answer your question, Jack?
Yeah.
Sometimes it might help if you walk. You get some exercise as well.
11 miles is it's a little long. Thanks for calling. 1-800-999-8255 is our number. We're talking about climate change and the day after tomorrow, this hour, and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Eileen, are you going to see the movie, do you think?
Well, I've been talking about the movie without seeing it for the last few days, so yes, I have to go see the movie.
what kind of reception is it receiving over there in your neighborhood?
Well, I mean, I'm on Science Friday, but half of my office went to see the movie. They haven't come back yet.
She had to be phoning into the theater at this moment, getting an instant review. And Kevin, I'm sure you're going to go out and see it.
Well, it's a similar situation here. Yeah. There's actually a party from NCAR going to see the movie this afternoon, I believe.
And what is their reaction as scientists to this? How do they take this as a good thing, or how do they view it as a pure science fiction film, or do they think it's going to stimulate discussion?
Well, I think one of the reactions from some of the people is indeed the concern that you expressed at the opening of the show, and that is that since so much of it is fiction and clearly physically impossible for a number of the things to happen, does that mean that global warming will be painted with the same brush? And so that's one concern that I have, but I haven't seen it, so to get the flavor of just what it's like.
And I asked the director earlier if he had seen The China Syndrome. Do you remember that film?
Yes, when the meltdown through the earth.
Right.
And it did have, if I'm not mistaken from remembering back, I thought it had a very major impact on the public and the future of or the decline in nuclear power. Do you agree with that, Eileen?
Yes, I do. I think it did have that kind of effect. Of course, I'm not sure that's exactly what we'd like to see here. We'd like to see a reasoned discussion and a set of programs and policies put in place at the federal level and the global level to deal with climate change as we know it and as we think it might unfold.
Do you think this might be less? The discussion might be less polarized now that this movie is out?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are many people who don't believe in global warming for whatever reasons, and actually they were the first ones that I've noticed who started talking about the film, and that actually gave it much more publicity than anyone would have imagined early on. They immediately started putting things on their website saying, you know, this is science fiction, it's not climate change, climate change is a myth. And the result of that has been that everybody else has started talking about it in a real kind of way. So, I mean, I'm actually optimistic. I don't take what you suggested as possible in the beginning, but I was afraid of it before. But now I actually think it will make people think about it. And that's what we need. We need people to think about it, to write to their congressman, to write to their governor, to make personal choices that are climate friendly.
Mm-hmm. And certainly a weekend, the fact that it's coming out on a weekend, where people will see it and talk about it amongst themselves.
Yes.
Can't hurt. And it's gotten a lot of free publicity. We're certainly talking about it here on our program.
Yeah, and I think that's all to the good, because I think we're talking about it in a way that isn't sensational, but in a way that makes people understand, at least for those who are listening, that this is real, and I think, furthermore, that we can actually do something about it.
You think this could be a catalyst for that?
I hope so.
Well, people would have to start writing their congresspeople.
Yes, they would.
Kevin, any last thought in the last few seconds we have?
Well, the question was raised about what you do about it, and I don't think it's actually so much what you do, but actually how you do it, and in particular how it gets implemented and over what kind of a time frame. And so, you know, if you were to do something radical by putting the cost of gasoline up by a dollar in order to cut down on demand, then that would have a huge impact. But, you know, if you did it very slowly over a period of a decade, then people would plan for it, and the next time they buy a car, they would buy a more fuel-efficient car or a hybrid or something like that. And as long as people can respond in a reasonable fashion to the changes and the incentives that are put in place, I think there's a lot that can be done.
If they see a plan in front of them of where it's going to lead to.
Yes, and if there's a signal from government that we ought to be taking this seriously.
All right, that's the last word. Before we'll go out and see the movie this weekend, I want to thank my guest, Eileen Clausen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change in Arlington, Virginia. Kevin Trenberth is the head of the Climate Analysis Section at the Lonely Inn Car in Boulder, Colorado today. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Rigo Cardi and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today, as we need it, from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. If you would like to send us some email, surf over to our website at Science Friday. You can also download back editions of Science Friday on your Audible player or listen to them on Real Audio. You can also leave us email there at sciencefriday.com. And if you missed any of the links we talked about today, they're up there for your perusal. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.